Yeah, thanks, Mike, for the introduction and for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here and a wonderful workshop, and I learned already a lot. I'm a philosopher of science with a background in physics. I work, as Mike said, at the Munich Center for Mathematical Philosophy, where we apply mathematical methods to address philosophical problems. So some of us work on logical methods, others use computer simulations, and still others use probabilistic methods, and I'm one of those people. So I would like to address philosophical problems, some selected philosophical problems, with probabilistic methods. This work is often pretty interdisciplinary. We work with psychologists, for example, and the work I will report today is also related to work done in the psychology of reasoning. You all know that Bayesianism is the leading theory of uncertain reasoning. It has many applications in artificial intelligence, in philosophy, in statistics, and in many other sciences. Now comes a joke, like established disciplines such as mechanics and electrodynamics. It has even been quantized already. I'm interested in developing the Bayesian framework and studying applications. I'm especially interested in understanding how one can learn different kinds of evidence which may not be propositional in nature. In those cases, Jeffrey conditionalization cannot be applied, and one has to find new ways of modeling how to learn that new information. And the proposal I will make is inspired by work in information theory, and it also relates to work in cognitive science. It raises a number of questions, I think, also for information theory, and I'll add those in later. Also hope that what I have to say has applications in physics. Now I come to the more specific topic, which begins with argumentation. So I would like to understand argumentation, which plays, of course, an important role in science and in our daily practice. Some arguments are convincing, others are not so convincing, and what one would like to have is a general theory that helps us to distinguish good arguments from bad arguments. There are many attempts to come up with such a theory, but there is nothing really universally accepted. All people agree that classical logic is way too narrow. It doesn't account for the uncertainty which is involved in argumentation. It doesn't allow for modeling argument schemes that are beyond logic, which may nevertheless be convincing, and so forth. What I would like to show is that this framework of Bayesian argumentation can be such a framework to model argumentation. And I proceed in a couple of steps. I first give you the main idea, what Bayesian argumentation is. Then we will see that conditionals play a particular role. They show up in many arguments. If you think of modus ponens or so, there is an if A, then B statement typically involved. And it turns out to be difficult to deal with conditionals in a Bayesian framework, mainly because it's not clear that conditionals are propositions, and that leads to a number of complications. To address this issue, I propose what we call the distance-based approach to Bayesianism, which uses probabilistic distance measures, such as the Kullback-Leibler divergence. And I'll then show what that implies for the topic of argumentation. So that's the plan for this talk. And I begin with the basic idea of Bayesian argumentation. An argument is simply a set of statements, which are called premises, which we use to support some other statement, the conclusion of the argument. And an argument is the better, the more the premises support the conclusion. But how do we assess arguments? A couple of factors play a role. One traditional factors to assess arguments is the structure. Yeah? Philosophers paid lots of attention to logically valid argument schemes, like modus ponens or so. And argument schemes which are not logically valid, that is, schemes that where the truth of the conclusion is not guaranteed if we know that the premises are true are considered to be fallacies. Another criterion is the content of the argument. We have to ask ourselves, are the premises of the argument plausible, and how plausible was the conclusion initially? And a third factor is the source that makes the argument. Is the source reliable that reports the premises, for example? There are different argument schemes. Here are two, modus ponens and modus tollens. There is others like affirming the consequent, where we start with one premise is the conclusion. A implies C is the second premise, the major premise, and we would like to infer A or so, and denying the antecedent. Now, affirming the consequent and denying the antecedent are fallacies in the sense of that they are not logically valid, but it has been pointed out that arguments that are not logically valid can also be of high value. Yeah? For example, confirmation works like this. Yeah? We have a general rule, we get evidence for the consequent of that conditional, and we would like to infer that we are now more sure that the antecedent of the conditional holds. Given that uncertainty plays an important role, this suggests that we should look at argumentation from a probabilistic point of view. And to do so, we need a framework. And I choose Bayesianism because it's the simplest, it's the most developed one. There is the machinery of Bayesian networks, which can be used to represent belief systems of people. And so it's a good starting point to use Bayesianism. If things don't work out, one can always use more sophisticated accounts such as imprecise probabilities and so forth. So here is the idea of Bayesian argumentation. We consider an agent who entertains two propositions only, A and B, and there is a probability distribution defined over it. So the agent believes A and B with a certain probability. Then someone makes a modus ponens argument. So someone claims A, and he also claims A implies C in order to convince the agent of the conclusion. So argumentation is kind of an indirect maneuver to convince someone else of a certain conclusion. One doesn't work directly on the conclusion. One manipulates the beliefs of the agent of the premises or so. So what happens then is that the agent, yeah, learns the premises. He becomes more certain that this premise is the case, for example, and he may become more certain that the conditional holds. And then, in order to have coherent beliefs, he has to update his probability distribution. And this update results, if the argument works well, in an increase of the probability of the conclusion of the argument. Yeah, that's the idea. And if one looks at this simple modus ponens scheme and represents the conditional A implies B by the material conditional, non-A or B, so we stay within classical logic, then one can show that if one updates by simple conditionalization the probability of the conclusion on A and non-A or C, then one gets one. Yeah? So that simply shows that this scheme here is consistent with classical logic. The idea of Bayesian argumentation is that argumentation is learning. So we start with prior beliefs, and then someone else comes along, manipulates our beliefs about the premises or so, and we then update because we want to hold a coherent set of beliefs. Now one may ask, what's the value of logical validity? Why perhaps should we prefer logically valid arguments to invalid argument schemes? And I will have to say more about this later. The first observation comes from Ernest Adams, who wrote a lot about these things and who formulated what is called the uncertainty sum rule. The idea is that in a logically valid argument, if the probability of one of the premises goes up, then the probability of the conclusion also goes up. However, if the underlying argument scheme is not logically valid, then raising the probability of one of the premises may lead to a decrease in the probability of the conclusion. And that Adams showed for arguments involving propositions. He defined the uncertainty of a proposition simply by 1 minus the probability of that proposition. And he then showed the static uncertainty sum rule. That is, that if there are certain prior premises and phi is a logical consequence of those prior premises, then the uncertainty of the consequent phi is always smaller than or equal than the sum of the uncertainties there. He also looked at a dynamical situation where a new premise, iota here, is learned, and he showed that a similar rule holds. The problem, however, is that he didn't consider conditionals in general, and conditionals have difficult formal structure, which I will show in a minute. So far, the basic idea of Bayesian argumentation is that we consider an agent who walks around with a Bayesian network of propositions, yeah, his or her belief set. Then the agent learns the premises of an argument, which prompts her to increase the probability of some of the premises or so, and she then updates using Jeffrey conditionalization or something like that, keeping the network structure unchanged in the simplest form, which leads to an increase or so of the probability of the conclusion. That machinery can be applied also to different argument schemes. But there are...
set of logical implication relations among propositions?
So. Not necessarily. Just you have a set of beliefs that hang together somehow, and you also accept certain conditional independencies or so. You may entertain a common cause structure of propositions or so, yeah. And in the simplest form of this scheme, I keep that fixed, yeah. So a bit in the spirit of Pearl, yeah. So that argumentation just manipulates probabilities or so. Yeah.
It's not in addition to the prior, because the prior contains all the conditional dependencies.
Yeah.
And so I can write down the Bayesian network for that prior. So ultimately, it's just the prior.
Yeah.
But when you say leaving the network structure unchanged in the second bullet point, if I update my probability distribution, things that are independent could end up being, could become dependent. So why should the network structure be unchanged?
Yeah, it may change, but in many of the cases where you just learn a premise or so, yeah, you just learn that the probability changes or so. But it can also be applied, and that's actually the power of the whole approach, that one can also learn things like causal structure. Yeah, so you may believe that A, B, and C are related in some kind of common cause a structure or so, yeah, but then you come to learn that it's actually a chain or a collider or something like that. And the machinery works for this as well. I'll show that in a minute. But in most standard cases or so, I take it that the causal structure of the beliefs or so is sort of fixed, and all the argument does is to manipulate the probabilities or so of some of the premises, which then has repercussions for the whole probability distribution. Okay? So that's the idea, but there are a number of issues that have to be addressed. Yeah, one is the situation where the conditional is non-extreme. Yeah. So in the previous example, I assumed that you become certain that the conditional obtains. I represented it by the material conditional. We conditionalized on the truth of that conditional or so. But often that is not achieved. So maybe the conditional probability or so goes up or so if we learn a conditional, but perhaps not to one. And in those cases, it's not clear what to do. Another issue is the question how the information gathering process is actually modeled. And it turns out that how that proceeds is highly important. And we are working on this at the moment. I'll say more about this in a later. Now I want to discuss the issue how we can model the learning of a conditional, and I first look at the case where the conditional is strict, yeah, so that we learn the conditional with a certainty, which is in a way very un-Bayesian or so, because Bayesianism is about uncertainty or so, but I assume that we learn it with certainty, and that raises already a number of issues. So there is an agent, he considers propositions A and C. There is a probability distribution defined over them. Then she learns the ordinary language indicative conditional if A then C, which I denote by this. And the question is, how should she update her beliefs in the light of this? Another question is whether conditionals have a probability at all, and whether indicative conditionals are propositions at all. One proposal for the probability of a conditional is Stalnaker's thesis. He simply identified the probability of the conditional A implies C by the probability of C given A. Stalnaker found this totally obvious and intuitive, but David Lewis and other people after him proved famous triviality results. Here is one of them. So we assume Stalnaker's thesis and we calculate the probability of A implies C. We use the law of total probability here. Then we use Stalnaker's thesis here. And if P of A and C and P of A and non-C are greater than zero, then we find that the probability of the conditional is the probability of the consequent of the conditional. And that's not good. Yeah, that's not what one would like to have. That's Lewis's triviality result. And that led many people to doubt that we can assign probabilities to conditionals at all. And in the next step, people doubted that conditionals are propositions at all, because it's typically propositions we assign probabilities to.
So I'm just curious what the mathematical framework is in which this is considered. So if A and C are random variables on the probability space, would this first expression P of A implying C actually be already well defined, or is more the question how would I want to define it? And then these calculations try to say that somehow.
Well, you can take it here as an extra proposition in the algebra or so, yeah? And then you use Stalnaker's rule here. So you could consider an algebra with A, C, and X, yeah? And do that.
You extend it some
yeah.
way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not clear for me whether Stalnaker's thesis holds, that it holds also for conditionals, because you have P of A arrow C given C, and then you use it.
Yeah, good point. Igor Duven made exactly that point and doubted that. Yeah, so that's what we assumed here. Absolutely right. Yeah, so one may say we only need it here for the conditional or so, and unconditionally there may be no problem. Absolutely fine, yeah? And I don't want to go with that skeptical position or so. I just wanted to introduce it, and I wanted to show that there are issues when it comes to conditionals. But if one gives up the view that conditionals are propositions, one gives up a lot. Yeah? I mean, certain conditionals seem to be true. Yeah? If I drink this glass of poison or so, I will die or so. Seems true. Yeah. Or at least highly likely, right? And to say that conditionals don't have a probability or so is sort of tricky. Yeah? But there are lots of issues which have to be addressed, and to a large extent I try to be out of this debate and come up with an account that doesn't commit me on the status of what a conditional is. Yeah.
For the non-philosophers, can you remind us what's the difference between an indicative conditional and a material conditional? Why are we not just taking not well, or C as the proposition yeah. probability we're trying to assign?
I'll come to this. So indicative conditional is the ordinary language if A then B. Yeah. Then the question is how can one formally represent it? Yeah, and if you want to do this in a Boolean algebra or so, the only option seems to be the material conditional, right? And but I will show that the material conditional gets into difficulties or so, and then one has to do something else.
So I'm curious, why did Stalnaker, we saw Stalnaker's proposal, but sort of a zeroth level proposal would have been, well, obviously we should think of P of A arrow C is just P of not A or C. Are you coming to why we're going to dismiss that, or is that already sort of...
They actually turn out to be identical if that probability is one, but I'll come back to that in a minute. It's interesting how all that relates. So, yeah, okay. Good. Okay, so I would now like to explore a bit more what follows if we represent the conditional by the material conditional and which problems... arise. So let's look again at an agent who entertains two propositions, A and C. Then the agent learns if A, then C. We represent the conditional by the material conditional, and one can then show that the probability of the antecedent of the conditional always goes down and the probability of the consequent always goes up. Yeah, that follows if the probability distribution is non-extreme, if there are no zeros and ones or so around. That seems plausible. People criticized that result. But one way to argue is once we learn the conditional, so once you learn if A, then C, you learn a consequence of A. So A becomes more informative. You can perhaps also falsify it easier if C does not obtain. And that's why you should decrease the probability of the antecedent. So it seems to be plausible, and I won't doubt that. So in my view, the material conditional does well here, although people like Popper and Miller criticized that also. Igor Duven came up with a number of counterexamples to using the material conditional in those contexts. But in my view, none of the examples is successful, basically because he forgot to model other relevant variables. Here is a famous example he gave, the ski trip example. Harry sees his friend Sue buying a skiing outfit. This surprises him a bit because he did not know of any plans of hers to go on a skiing trip. He knows that she recently had an important exam and thinks it's unlikely that she passed. Then he meets Tom, his best friend and also a friend of Sue, who is just on his way to Sue to hear whether she passed the exam and who tells him, if Sue passed the exam, then her father takes her on a skiing vacation. Now, recalling his earlier observation, Harry now comes to find it more likely that Sue passed the exam. So I take it that we all have this intuition that given the context described in this story, that the probability of the antecedent of the conditional, that she passed the exam, goes up. Yeah, and that contradicts this here, and so Igor Duven thought that it's a counterexample to using the material conditional to represent the conditional here. Yeah, but he forgot that there is a third variable involved, namely that Sue buys a skiing outfit. That was unexpected because she is not known to be a skier or so. Yeah, so we also learn B. Yeah, and that apparently then, if one does it properly, makes sure that the probability of E goes up. And one can show that it holds in those cases. One can also see that network seems to represent the causal structure, E causes S causes B, and at the same time B is independent of E given S. That seems to be plausible, but one doesn't need it. It follows simply from the probability calculus if one also conditions on B. So the material conditional doesn't have a problem, and that holds for other examples. One can all analyze them with the material conditional, but the problems for the material conditional show up if one considers non-extreme conditional probability. So it's un-Bayesian to assume that the conditional is strict, that always if A, then C holds or so. At best, we become somehow more certain, a conditional probability or so goes up. And the information gathering process also plays a role. I look at the first problem, so how can we understand non-strict conditionals or learning non-strict conditionals? And to do so, I develop the distance-based approach to Bayesianism. So you all know that if we learn a proposition, if we learn that a certain proposition is true, we use conditionalization, which means that the new probability of a hypothesis H, P star of H, is the old conditional probability measure. So we condition on the truth of E, and then using the definition of the conditional probability, we can express this here in terms of the likelihood, the prior, and the expectancy of the evidence. But the philosophical thing is this here: how do we justify that the new probability measure of H is the old conditional measure? It holds if the new probability of the evidence is one, if we become certain. If we don't become certain of the evidence, if we just increase the probability of the evidence, yeah, if it goes, for example, from 0.4 to 0.9 or so, then we should use a Jeffrey conditionalization, which is this convex sum here. And Jeffrey conditionalization follows from the law of total probability, yeah, P star or P prime is the new probability here, and Jeffrey conditionalization holds if these probabilities here, P of H given EI, are equal before and after the update, right? So if the rigidity condition holds, then Jeffrey conditionalization seems to be the right thing. But this basically means that the likelihoods don't change. The distance-based approach generalizes all this. It's supposed to also work when the evidence we learn is non-propositional. And the basic idea is that we consider again an agent who has beliefs, probability distribution represents those beliefs, and then the agent learns something. And what the agent learns then poses a constraint on the new probability distribution. So some constraint, and this constraint, of course, typically doesn't fully fix the new probability distribution. It's only a constraint on the new distribution. So we have to find a criterion to work out the full new distribution. And we do this by applying a norm called conservativity. We assume that the agent doesn't want to change her beliefs too much. Yeah? Of course, the agent wants to make sure that the constraint is satisfied or so, but apart from this, she wants to make as few changes as possible. That requires a distance measure between probability distributions, and a candidate measure is the Kullback-Leibler divergence. In fact, what we request is that any admissible distance measure implies Jeffrey conditionalization. So if we learn that the probability of one proposition changes somehow, yeah, then using a distance function to calculate the new probability distribution should give us a Jeffrey conditionalization. Yeah, and it turns out that this approach can be used to model other kinds of evidence than propositional evidence, as I will show in a minute. Here's the Kullback-Leibler divergence. You have seen that, of course, many times before. P is the old distribution. Q is the new distribution. It's not a distance function. It's not symmetrical. It doesn't satisfy the triangle inequality. And yet, it's very useful. A generalization of the Kullback-Leibler divergence, in a way, is the F divergence, which Cheza came up with in the 60s or so. And here we need a convex function F with F of 1 is 0. And the F divergence is then defined in this way, the sum over pi, F of qi over pi. If this convex function is T log T, we get Kullback-Leibler, but we can also get the inverse Kullback-Leibler divergence. This is a Q, and the Hellinger distance or the chi-square divergence and so forth. The interesting thing to note is that all F divergences imply Jeffrey conditionalization, or conditionalization, of course, in a limit then. Yeah? So if you learn a proposition, yeah, if you learn that the probability of a proposition changes or goes to 1 or so, then if you minimize the F divergence between the new and the old distribution, you get a Jeffrey conditionalization. So we have a nice class of distance functions that satisfy a norm that I would like to accept for updating. So F divergences are a good starting point to model other kinds of evidence.
Question?
Yes.
Is it the case that you get Jeffrey conditionalization if you use any function that preserves relative majorization? The F divergence, it looks a bit like sort of any sure convex function extended to the case of relative majorization. But is it
that's the idea? That's the idea. Yeah.
That's all of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So F has to be convex. And then you preserve the ratios, basically, of conditional probabilities,
You say they imply Jeffrey conditionalization, so that's when the constraint is, here are the new values of this.
Okay. Yeah, it's very easy to show with Lagrange multipliers or so. You just add this as a constraint, and it turns out the detailed nature of the function f isn't important or so. You always get it. Yeah, so that's really nice. Now, if one looks at learning indicative conditionals, if A then C from a perfectly reliable source, then it turns out that Q of C given A is 1, which is the constraint that is sort of inspired by Stalnaker's thesis, is equivalent with Q of non-A or C, that is, the material conditional is 1, because of this theorem of the probability calculus. Yeah? So you get the same result if you impose the constraint Q of C given A is 1 on the new distribution, or if you impose the constraint non-A or C, which follows from using the material conditional. But this equation here also tells us that if the conditional is not strict, if Q of C given A or Q of non-A or C is smaller than 1, then the other one of the two is not fixed, because Q of A may also change. So it's kind of a happy coincidence or so, that in the strict case, the material conditional gives the same result as one gets if one uses the Stalnaker type constraint. In other cases, if the conditional is not strict, one gets different results. So this shows that this sort of shows or establishes that the material conditional is totally okay. Yeah, if we like this perspective here, if the conditional is strict. Yeah, but if it's not strict, it may not work, and it actually does not work. So Jeffrey conditionalizing on the material conditional leads to strange results, as one can show. Now, one issue is that one gets different results in the case of non-strict conditionals for different F divergencies. So it then matters which F divergence one uses. And there is a bit of an anything goes objection here. So it would be nice to come up with further norms that restrict the class of possible divergencies. And if one likes epistemic utility theory, like Richard Pettigrew and his friends, and considers minimizing inaccuracy as an additional norm, then it turns out that KL is the only divergence in the intersection of the two. Yeah? So the class of F divergencies gives us Jeffrey conditionalization, and the class of Bragman divergencies is used in epistemic utility theory, and the overlap is just KL. Yeah? So if you like accept those two norms, then you should only use KL. Yeah, I like KL, but I think it's interesting to explore the space of F divergencies a bit further, and it also kicks off a research program in psychology also, because people can fit different F divergencies to data. Yeah.
So there are these axiomatic derivations of the maximum entropy principle and of the KL divergence minimization. Are there similar ideas here?
I guess so. That's a good question. We tried to come up with a more axiomatic approach, but we didn't make too much progress. There's interesting things to do. Yeah, it's a good point. Okay, good. So now I want to show that different F divergencies give different results if the conditional is not strict. Yeah, and a famous example is the Judy Benjamin problem, which probably some of you have seen already. It's a problem by van Frasen. We consider a soldier who is dropped with her platoon in a territory that is divided into four parts, and R, non-R, S, non-S. And initially, she doesn't know where she is, yeah, where she landed. So we assign a probability of 1/4 to each of those four. Then she gets a radio message, yeah. I cannot be sure where you are. If you are in red territory, if you are on this side here, yeah, then the odds are 3-1 that you are in S, in second company. Yeah, that's the information you get. It comes in the form of a conditional, but it's kind of a probabilistic conditional because it's not strict. Yeah, we only learn something about the odds, which are 3-1. And the question is, how should Judy update her beliefs? Yeah, so many people, I don't know what your views are, but many people would say that she should go to... should keep those probabilities here the same and then simply do that. 3/8, 1/8, and 1/4 here, 1/4 there. The idea is we only learn something about what happens if you are in R, so that side should not be affected or so. And here the odds are 3-1, so 3/8. 1/8. That's what many people would think is the intuitively correct answer, but it turns out that if you do KL minimization, you find that the new probability of R is a bit smaller than 1/2. Yeah, and van Frasen and others took this to challenge the Kullback-Leibler divergence as an updating rule. So if we accept that this is the proper translation of this conditional here into a constraint, yeah, then there might be a problem. Yeah, but people have argued to sort of defend the Kullback-Leibler divergence that we should consider the case that the odds here go to infinity, so we replace a 3-1 by n-1, and we let n go to infinity. And if n goes to infinity, then we basically find that this here becomes 0, right? So we exclude one of the four quarters, right? And people say the only thing I learned from the conditional is that we exclude this upper left quarter. So initially we had four possibilities, now we have three, we have no additional information. Yeah. So in that limit, all those guys here get 1/3. Yeah, and in that case, of course, the new probability of R is 1/3, smaller than 1/2. And if we accept this kind of reasoning, yeah, then Q of R, it's totally okay to accept also that if n is 3, yeah, if the odds are 3 to 1, it's a bit smaller than 1/2. So somehow the distribution moves a bit around or so, and that condition also affect the other side, yeah, of things. So that's a way to defend the Kullback-Leibler divergence. But it turns out, yeah, that things depend on which F divergence one uses. If one uses the inverse Kullback-Leibler divergence, yeah, then nothing changes and one gets exactly this intuitive result. If one uses other divergences like the Hellinger distance or the chi-square or something, then one sees that it's symmetrical around 1/2. Of course, for 1/2 it should be the same, yeah, and it always goes down, yeah. So this is a delta as a function of that. What one finds is that for all F divergences, these two are equally large, and they of course have to stand in the ratio k. Okay. So there is a dependence on the F divergence, which suggests that in cases where the condition is not strict, which is typically what we do when we get information or so, we wouldn't go up to 1. Yeah, things depend on the particular F divergence. That's the result. Some people might also want to argue that we do not only get the constraint that Q of S given R is K from the example, but that we also learn the constraint when we read the example that the probability of R shouldn't change. So one could accept this as an additional constraint on the distribution, yeah? One could say, well, the conditional really only tells us about what's happening on the, if we are on that side here, and it is totally doesn't tell us anything about the other side or so. So if we translate the story somehow into these two constraints, then it turns out that the new probability of R is 1/2 and all F divergences give the same result. So I'm only saying this because it's sometimes not quite clear which constraints are implied by such a story or so. Okay, now that was the part on modeling how to learn a conditional. Yeah, we come back now to Bayesian argumentation. I told you that I proposed that argumentation is learning. We learn the premises of an argument. The tricky ones are the conditionals. They have to be treated with care. And I'll now try to come back to what Adam said about the value of logically valid arguments, and I would like to investigate if all that also holds if we model conditionals in this more sophisticated way. So we consider an agent who entertains beliefs represented by a Bayesian network, and there's a prior probability distribution defined over it. We then some other person makes an argument, as a result of which we change the probabilities of the premises. We keep for now the network structure unchanged. What we learn poses constraints on the new probability distribution Q, and we find the new probability distribution Q by minimizing some F divergence between Q and P. And that results in a change of the probability of the conclusion. And of course, if the argument is successful, probability of the conclusion goes up. So here is modus ponens. we learn A and we learn A implies B. So there are, in the strict case, two constraints. Q of A is 1 and Q of B given A is 1. There is no need to minimize anything here because these two constraints fully fix already the new distribution, and we get Q of B is 1, which is what we should expect because the argument is logically valid. The same for modus tollens. Here we learn non-B, so the new probability of non-B is 1, and as a result, the new probability of non-A is 1. Here we have to minimize, and all F-divergences give this result. Now it's a bit more interesting here. So we look at a not valid argument scheme, affirming the consequent. We learn B, A implies B with those constraints. And it then turns out that the new probability of A is the old conditional probability of A given B, yeah, which makes a lot of sense if A and B are initially highly correlated or so, yeah, and you then learn B, yeah, that also has raises the probability of A. Yeah, so the new probability is the old conditional probability, and the same holds for denying the antecedent. So we learn non-A, in which case the new probability of non-B is non-B, the old probability of non-B given non-A. So these are the simple cases. The power of the machinery comes when we look at uncertain minor premises and uncertain major premises. So if we only learn that the probability of A goes up, yeah, so we don't become certain that A is the case, but the other person who wants to convince us convinces us at least that A is more likely than we originally thought, yeah, then we find that the probability of B is always greater than before. Yes?
Can you remind me what minor and major?
Yeah, minor is this and major is that, sorry. Yeah, major is the conditional. Yeah, so, okay. The same holds for modus tollens. And if we look at an invalid argument scheme, like affirming the consequent, we find that the new probability of the conclusion can be greater or smaller than the prior one, yeah? Depending basically on how A and B are initially correlated. So if they were negatively correlated in our prior probability distribution, then we actually decrease the probability of the conclusion of the argument if the probability of the minor premise here goes up. Yeah? And the same holds for denying the antecedent. And with what I just said about learning conditionals, we can also model the case where we are still uncertain about the major premise. So we assume that the probability of the minor premise doesn't change and that the probability of the major premise goes up. So Q of B given A goes up, is greater than P of B given A, in which case for the logically valid argument schemes, the probability of the conclusion always goes up, and if the argument scheme is not valid, it may go up or down. So that leads to a conjecture, which is a generalization of what Adams proved for the propositional case, is that if the underlying argument pattern is logically valid, then the probability of the conclusion always increases if the probability of at least one of the premises increases. For arguments which are not logically valid, this is not the case. Yeah, that's a conjecture which is plausible and which I have shown for particular examples or so, but it's difficult, at least for us, it was difficult to prove it in full generality. But that would sort of, even for probabilists or so, show that there is some value to logically valid argument schemes. Yeah. Okay, so what I have done here is I have shown that, or argued that argumentation is a dialogical endeavor. There's one agent who wants to convince another agent of the conclusion. He or she does this in an indirect way by manipulating the probabilities of the premises, and we make sure that agent in question, agent two, always wants to have a coherent probability distribution, so he or she updates using minimizing some F divergence. All right, one can look at other argument patterns. I have only shown very simple argument patterns like modus ponens and modus tollens, but within this Bayesian framework of argumentation, one can also model more complicated and new argument schemes, which often draw on a new or different causal structure. In standard arguments, there is often a direct connection between, for example, a theory and the evidence or so. Yeah? So all ravens are black is the theory, this raven is black, there's a direct connection between the two. But there are interesting new argument schemes that scientists use to convince each other or so, where there may be a correlation between the evidence and the hypothesis or so, but it's not of a direct nature. And the power of the Bayesian approach is that there is common cause structures which can be used for that. And I have some examples here, but I don't do that because we are running already a little late, and I just come to the outlook. What I have tried to show is I wanted to sketch a unified Bayesian theory of argumentation. The basic idea was that argumentation is a dynamical thing. It involves learning the premises. People have prior beliefs and then learn the premises of the argument. To work this out, we had to pay special attention to conditionals, which are tricky and need a careful treatment. That was done in the distance-based approach to Bayesianism. I argued that it is consistent with Jeffrey conditionalization, but that if the conditional, for example, is non-extreme, that we get different predictions for different F-divergences, which invites for further normative work and also further empirical work. And I also think that all this should have applications in information theory and in physics. And it would be interesting to think more about that. Here are the papers and a book on which this stuff drew. This is the main paper here, which is also on the Phil Tsai archive. All right, thanks very much.
We have a few minutes for questions.
So I hadn't heard of the Judy Benjamin problem before.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that it's conceivable that it's an example where it matters how the information that led to the conditional probability was obtained. To figure out how, you know, there's this multiplicity of ways I could update based on learning that, you know, that there's this conditional P of S given R. And so it seems analogous to me to a situation that when you're pooling information, right? So
mm-hmm.
I have two Bayesian agents, and they have both some information about a variable X. So I tell you, you know, Alice assigns P1 of X, Bob assigns P2 of X, and now, say, Bob learns that Alice assigns P1 of X. He can't just, for example, multiply those distributions together and say, that's my new information. It depends on whether the evidence that Alice had about X was just a copy of his evidence, or whether it's completely independent of his evidence. That will determine how he's going to combine those two distributions.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's a way out of this multiplicity of updatings, where you could say, well, like I'm thinking in your example, if the person who communicates to the soldier knows that it's not S bar if it's R because they looked in that square and they didn't land there, then it's a third, a third, a third is the right choice. But if it was instead of, we did two measurements, one could just, was a sort of, are you left, are you right, we got no information, are you on the bottom, are you on the top, we find you're not on the bottom, well,
mm-hmm.
then it seems like it's the other pattern that you should update. So it's sort of, Without the information of how that conditional was acquired, you just don't know how to apply it to your data.
I mean, the problem is clearly underdetermined in all sorts of respects. Yeah, that is an issue. Yeah, and but the question is perhaps what conclusion you should draw from the minimal information that you get from the example. Yeah. So here I took it for granted, or Judy took it for granted, that the information is perfectly reliable or so. Yeah, it's from her boss back home or so. Yeah, and that this translation of the information that is provided into the constraint, that Q of S given R is 3/4 or so, that's uncontroversial. Yeah? But much more could be done along those lines and along other lines. You may assign a reliability to the source or so, and then all sorts of trouble occurs, also for the conditional, actually. Another underdetermination, which I wanted to point out, however, is that it really depends on which F divergence you use. Yeah, so it's underdetermined. Yeah, if you take as the only constraint Q of S given R is 3/4, and if you are happy with being consistent with Jeffrey conditionalization or so then basically anything goes, as this figure shows. Yeah, so you can say I like the inverse Kullback-Leibler divergence, and you do this here, yeah, or you somehow you use some other divergence, and you get a different result. So the whole thing is pretty underdetermined in various dimensions.
Do you agree that a possible explanation of the underdetermination is that it's not a well-posed problem? Because that's sort of the gist of what I'm saying, is that there are certain problems that they seem well posed, but then upon further reflection, they're not, like the pooling problem. There is no answer to the question, how should Alice take Bob's probability distribution and combine it with her to get a new one? If she doesn't have extra information about how Bob obtained the distribution, her right response is not, oh, well, I have to find the right response. This is just not a well posed problem. I could tell you for each of the possible ways in which Bob could have gotten his information, here's how I would do it. If this problem feels a bit like that.
Many problems are like this, yeah, that the translation of a story or something into hard constraints is non-trivial.
But yeah? I think it's the translation. I think it's that the story leaves out key information that a Bayesian needs.
No, you don't need that. As a Bayesian, you just get whatever you get and you update. Yeah?
So how would you then, okay, so Bob just learns that Alice assigns the probability distribution P2 of X to a variable that he assigns the probability distribution P1 of X to. So I've just told you everything that Bob learned. Now, as a Bayesian, what's he supposed to do? Is there a unique solution?
No, but I guess one thing to do is to take this other person as a peer. Yeah. So if you don't know that she is less or more reliable, then
it's not about reliability though. Like it doesn't matter. Like you might think that Alice is a liar, but imagine that Bob trusts Alice. The problem is he doesn't know how Alice got to her state of belief. That's the key. That there's some causal mechanism, and it could be she's using the same data. Mm-hmm. So if they were Gaussians and he multiplied those two Gaussians together, it'd be narrower, and that would be wrong because it's the same data. Or it could be independent data.
Yeah.
So it feels like it's not about reliability. Mm. It's about the statement of the problem not containing information that's relevant to solve it.
I think we had a...
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to agree with Rob.
You were going to agree?
Yeah. I think that was my reaction to the Judy Benjamin problem too. It matters crucially. The thing is, Judy doesn't know what she's being told until she's told, well, how did you arrive at those judgments that these are the right probabilities, and it matters.
I mean, there is this step involved, but my focus here was really on showing that even if we agree on a way of capturing things, there's still a second level of underdetermination because of the method we are using. Yeah?
That might be okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not disputing that.
But I think it looks complex because we're in a some middle case, but we have first to answer the question n equals infinity, and this will dictate how you update your belief when n equals 3. You know, like n equals infinity was, if you are in R, then you are in S.
Yeah.
And you said in one case, it's going to go to 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. And in another case, it might go to 1/2, 1/4, 1/4.
I mean, the n to infinity case was just meant to make plausible that the new probability of R can be smaller than 1/2.
But I'm not necessarily convinced of that. And I think it relates with what Rob says, the way you get your information. If you're a priori, you're convinced you have only like your priori. It's 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, and then you learn. It couldn't be. Okay, I see. Yeah, the information could be updated in two different ways, and depending on which way it's going to be updated, if your n to infinity case converges to 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. Then you should not update it the way it's written on the blackboard on the right. You should update it the way you said. So you make the continuous case.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So we have another discussion period after lunch. So we can continue the discussion. For now, let's thank Mr. Long for your time.